Good morning. Please be seated. All right, this morning we have on calendar the matter of Olson versus Anderson Dairy, case number 72457. When both sides are ready to begin, make sure that you please state your name for my clerk, any party that may be with you. And I want to ask the appellant, would you like any rebuttal time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Three minutes. That will be the order. All right, thank you. You can proceed whenever you'd like.
Your Honors, good morning. May it please the court. My name is Bradley Schrader from Wolf Rifkin. I'm here on behalf of Appellant Kenneth Olson, who is also here in the courtroom with us here today. This is a workers' compensation appeal of a denial of claim concerning an industrial incident that left Mr. Olson blind in both eyes. Now, workers' compensation appeals are always very difficult for reviewing courts. They oftentimes come down to battles with the doctors. But at the same time, credibility and even scientific judgments are made in these cases, not just by a jurist immediately below you, which is the normal course of action, but also much more remote from you in hearings and appeals proceedings at the agency level. This causes us to reach down through layers to provide the adequate review that that the appellants are entitled to. Now, it's also very difficult sometimes for appellants in workers' compensation cases because of the particular procedures and standards. There are not that many ways into the case by an appellate court. I believe, however, that in this particular instance, we're going to find some grounds that will permit this court to act in ways that are favorable to my client. Now, one of the ways in which the court can delve into a workers' compensation appeal and an agency decision is noted in 233B-135-3, which says that the court may remand or affirm the final decision or set it aside in whole or in part if substantial rights of the petitioner have been prejudiced. This sort of opens up a procedural look at what happened below. And here I want to first open with what happened at the district court that I think this court should be concerned about. Now, in many ways, my client, Mr. Olson, was unlucky at the district court level. The hearing in his petition for judicial review was set for mid-January. On January 1st of that year, there was a reshuffling of the departments, which can often lead to, if not confusion on the parts of parties, then at least judges very quickly trying to get up to speed. Mr. Olson's case was submitted to Department 18, which at the time was vacant.
Well, counsel, why do we care? We're not reviewing what the district court did. We're reviewing what the appeals officer did.
And Sally Orr was on the bench for many, many years, like 20 years. So she's certainly familiar with, as a senior judge, as a petition for judicial review.
Absolutely right. I would take on board all of that. However, as the context of what I'm about to describe, perhaps the shortness of time and the size of the record led to particular circumstances in the district court that prejudiced my client, right? And if you go through the district court's transcript and the order, it is not entirely clear that a fully adequate review was undertaken, right? My client has a right to, after an agency decision, two levels of review, right? The review at the district court level, and then a second review, if necessary, at this court level. And certainly, Judge Lohr, I cast absolutely no aspersions. But going through the record carefully, there are moments in which it's not clear that the adequate review to which my client was entitled was undertaken. It is not entirely clear that the standard under which the district court was operating was correct. She repeatedly referred to it as grossly erroneous as opposed to clearly erroneous. Now, that may be a minor point. She may have meant clearly erroneous. But further on, there are indications in the record that the district court was not entirely correct as to what she could or could not do for my client in the review. In fact, there are several instances in which the district court says only the Supreme Court can give you relief. This court as well, I mean. Only the Supreme Court can reweigh the medical evidence. Only the Supreme Court can look at the facts of the matter.
How do we reweigh the medical evidence? irregardless of what Judge Lohr said, we're looking at the appeals officer's decision. So let's just take her out of the mix. How do we reweigh what happened below?
Right.
And you can tell from the records that that appeals officer put a lot of weight into the fact that the petitioner either did or did not give all of the medical records, perhaps, to the USC doctors. It seems that the appeals officer really focused on the two doctors and then decided on the one that had reviewed all of the records.
Well, in the record, there were actually three doctors, two specialists for my client, and one which was just a reviewing doctor for the other side. And we can talk a little bit later. I understand the whole presumption and warden or non-presumption regarding reviewing doctors versus examining doctors. We can get to that.
Was there anything in the record, though, during the administrative proceeding that would have shown that those doctors had his medical records as opposed to just the petitioner telling those doctors his medical history?
Well, let me answer that this way. You have to understand the sort of progress of Mr. Olson before those doctors. At the time in which Mr. Olson saw those specialists, he was not necessarily concerned with building a record so that he could win a workers' compensation case. His primary concern was getting back his sight.
Right? Was getting what?
His sight back.
Right.
Right, being able to see. So the records that and you're speaking of the USC doctors.
Right.
Those in Southern California, Mr. Roger, Dr. Roger, and Dr. Levine. No, there's nothing in the record saying that they would have had all the records. But there's also nothing in the record that shows that respondent's doctor had all the records. Respondent's doctor was also obviously hired by the insurance company, was given, I presume, a narrative of the case, which probably jibed with their particular position.
Mr. Schrager, could you clarify what the doctors at USC had? Because Dr. Rogers starts out his report saying that Mr. Olson reported that he was in a normal state of health, and Dr. Levine starts out his report stating that Mr. Olson said he was in his usual state of health. So what did that mean, normal and usual, compared to you, compared to the general public, compared to himself? What did that mean?
I can't exactly answer what that meant. And I don't think the record shows exactly every piece of paper that those doctors would have had in their hands.
But what we're saying is, where in the record can we, what if we completely agree and we say, gosh, the two USC doctors, they're rock stars next to the guy that just was retained. And I'm just saying, hypothetically, we say they're rock stars next to the guy who's retained by the other side to do a records review. Where do we cannot reweigh what the appeals officer's decision is regarding credibility. We can, however, look to see whether or not the appeals officer erred somewhere. So tell us where in that record we can find that the appeals officer would have erred by stating that the USC doctors did not look at medical records of the petitioner. Does that make sense? Tell us where in the record we can see he erred.
On that particular point, I think it's fairly clear that the USC doctors did not have the entirety of the records that respondent's doctor had. That's certainly true. The advantage that the USC doctor has is they had the patient. They had the patient and they ran batteries of tests to do differential diagnosis, to rule out everything possible except toxic exposure, right? And so that became, given the information given to those doctors, which is virtually uncontroverted in the testimony at the appeals level, that the incident occurred in the way that my client describes it. Right?
Is there something in the record that shows that the chemicals at the plant were actually toxic and could lead to blindness?
Absolutely. In fact, we've submitted, I can find the record, it's in the brief, the safety sheets are listed in it, and the safety sheets at the very top say these chemicals cause blindness, right? Exposure to these chemicals. And, you know, sort of one thing that is not fleshed out in any record, and especially not by respondent's doctor, is what is the interaction of these chemicals? He states to a medical certainty, there's no way this exposure could have caused my client's condition. I don't know how that's possible when there's no discussion of those chemicals at all. I mean, at the very least, my client's doctors delved into that question, right? So the exposure itself is virtually uncontrovertible. When we talk about credibility determinations, and you know, I do want to talk about weighing of the evidence, because when we talk about whether a decision is supported by substantial evidence, and we also know what substantial evidence means in the case law, right? It's the quantity and quality of evidence which a reasonable person could accept adequate to support a conclusion. We have to work back from that, right? What is the conclusion we're looking to be adequate for the evidence that is given? And so when we do that, we don't silo the evidence and say, well, what did respondent's doctor say? Does that make sense? Okay, fine. No, you have to judge adequacy in relation to other evidence. And in this particular regard, the adequacy of the evidence on respondent's side simply doesn't adduce. Right? The conclusion that respondent's doctor comes up with is that appellant's doctors merely think that because these two things happen close in time, the one caused the other, right? That you were exposed to chemicals and you had vision impairment, therefore you think that they are close in time, but there's all these other reasons why somebody could go blind. Well, it is not as if my client was exposed to these chemicals, and as I say, that's uncontroverted in the record, exposed to these chemicals, and then a year later started to have trouble with his eyes and remembered, hey, maybe I saw something at the top of that boiler which was untoward, right? That's not what happened. That very night, Mr. Olson started suffering from these things, went to the emergency room the next day, and then went through batteries of tests and several doctors in order to get to the specialist that could answer his questions about his eyes. Not about his case, about his eyes, right?
Right.
So, yes.
I know you're running out of time here, so really fast. You started out mentioning the statute and the options that the court has.
Right.
Did Mr. Olson ever request an IME? Is that even necessary? Because you know, it was mentioned, well, why didn't the other side ask for the IME? Instead, they had this records review instead of a full independent exam. What can we do in that regard? Is that a serious problem in this case?
I think it's a very serious problem in this case, and I think it's another way in for this court to act, which is I can't really tell why there would be any other reason for NRS 616C, 360 sub C, which is the appellate officer's ability to order an independent medical examiner, than for this very case. Right? Here we have an obvious medical dispute between...
But does the claimant, the injured person, need to ask for it, or did just the appeals officer would do it on his own, just kind of out of the blue?
Well, the statute contemplates that if there's a medical dispute rising to a particular level, and I think we could all agree that this rises to that particular level of one saying, don't be silly, it was his diabetes, which is a very low level, and tobacco use that caused his blindness the very same day, versus toxic exposure. That's a very serious medical dispute. The statute contemplates that the appeals officer should employ his discretion at that point to order an IME, because one thing that would have helped this case was an independent voice that neither side would have much ability to discredit the authority of. Right? It's not your doctor. It's not my doctor. It's a doctor, independent, because respondent's doctor, and once again, I understand the whole treating physician non-presumption, he's actually called an IME doctor in the order. Now, that may have led to Judge Lohrer having more confidence in the decision than perhaps it warranted, because Dr. Hauschen, the respondent's doctor, was neither independent and performed no medical examination. It was merely a records review, and did so a week before the hearing.
It wasn't in the appeals officer's letter, but it was in the order, you're right. And maybe the judge was misled. But again, we're focusing on the appeals officer. So do they need to say to the appeals officer, the claimant, or the respondent, we have a dispute in medical records here. There's a serious dispute. Let's have an IME. Or is the appeals officer just supposed to say, oh, I think there is a dispute. I'm going to independently order it.
I think either one of those would be acceptable.
But what happened here?
Well, certainly a patient or a claimant could do that. That's not what the statute contemplates. You could ask, but you don't have to ask. And in fact, in this instance, going into the hearing, a week before the hearing, the evidence that was in evidence were the reports from my client's two doctors.
Well, but the standard here is abuse of discretion. If nobody asked the appeals officer to do it, you want to say that the appeals officer abused his discretion by not doing it on his own. But, I mean, where does that lead? If that's an abuse of discretion, if nobody asked for it, then what you're saying is every time there's a dispute between doctors, then the appeals officer must order an IME, and then it's no longer discretionary.
No, that's Judge Howe, I take that on board, but I don't think every time. I don't think it would become a blanket rule. Just like any other judgment about someone abusing their discretion, you would look at the facts of the particular circumstance, and you would say, this is one that calls for that.
But if the parties themselves don't give any indication to the appeals officer that they think this is that serious a dispute, how is the appeals officer supposed to, you say he just has to do it on his own?
That's what the statute contemplates.
But if the parties are silent on it, doesn't that suggest to the appeals officer that they don't think it is that big a deal?
I don't think it would suggest that it's not that big.
I'm going to give you 2 minutes rebuttal because you've got asked a lot of questions at the end.
No, it's fine.
Go ahead and finish your question.
I'll say that yes, I do think it is the responsibility of the appeals officer in these particular instances to know their options. And if there is discretion in the statute that can be exercised, that certainly means that it can be abused, whether or not the claimant brings that forward or not. It's the same as being a judge in other instances. You know the sources of your power of jurisdiction and the limits of those things, what you can and can't do. The appeals officer ought to be informed about his or her jurisdiction, role, and discretion at the same level, especially in a case like this, where we're talking about doctors, you know, clashing in this way over matters so serious.
Thank you. We'll give you 2 minutes because of all the questions at the end. Thank you so much. We'll hear from respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is David Benavides. I represent Travelers Insurance and insure the Anderson Dairy. Excuse me. To answer your question regarding an IME, because that came up in counsel's open brief and his reply brief, it's a discretionary statute under NRS 616C360. The appeals officer may find a medical question. He doesn't have to. If you read through the transcript, and I read through it in its entirety, and we were adopted in, neither of us were on this case.
Well, I think his argument is even whenever a statute's discretionary, right, the fact that there's such a term that we use very often called abuse of discretion means every discretionary question has its limits. And I think his argument is in this case, you have doctors who each seem to lack a piece of information. Some of the doctors didn't see the patient. Some of the doctors saw the patient but not the records. Why not get a doctor who sees everything? Because, you know, you potentially have not just a disagreement on opinion, but a disagreement on process and how they reach their opinion. And in that case, I think his argument is it might be abuse of discretion because it's a little bit different than other cases where doctors see everything but they just disagree. I may be extrapolating a little bit from his argument, but I gather that's where he's going with it.
And I understand his argument, but, and I'll answer your question, but to finish up what I was saying, the appeals officer considered everything. He considered the testimony. There was no request by either counsel. They were so embedded in their argument that their positions were correct that no one asked for a medical question. It wasn't even hinted. It was all or nothing. And
what about the argument on appeal by the appellant that these pre-existing maladies such as diabetes and high blood pressure contributed to the occupational disease?
That's exactly what these doctors said. If you look at Dr. Levine...
That there was a pre-existing condition, but that this toxic whatever caused his blindness. Why did the, it seems like in your brief you did not respond to that issue.
I'm not sure the appeals officer even made a finding that he was exposed to toxic. He heard the testimony of a witness, James Goldborough, that actually worked in the same location, and he testified that there was some construction. He found this witness credible. He did not find the claimant credible. He did not find Dr. Levine credible or Dr. Damian Rogers credible. He found Dr. Kenneth Houchin credible. So he's the fact finder. He sat and listened, and this transcript is huge. He sat and listened to all the testimony. If you look at these doctors' records, Dr. Levine, the claimant told him he was a non-smoker, pre-existing condition. He did not have his records. He did not have his records from Southwest Medical, and there was another doctor in there as well that he's treated for years for.
So what would his records shown? He's got diabetes. He told him he has diabetes. What more would the records have shown? And this is the whole reason why he disregarded the other two doctors.
Well, he disregarded.
If they were presented with, I have high blood pressure, I'm a smoker, and I have diabetes, what more would those records have presented to him?
But what the appeals officer looked at is Dr. Levine was presented with a statement from the claimant that he was a non-smoker. He wasn't a non-smoker. He had smoked for 30 years. I'm not sure he quit today as we sit here. Damian Rogers didn't have all the records. He wasn't provided with the MRIs, and the claimant told him that the MRIs were normal. Well, the MRIs verified he had pre-existing non-industrial conditions in his eyes that pre-existed this alleged event. Now, witness James Goldberg testified that he saw the construction, but when the floor was being cut, there was a vacuum following the floor cut, and they were wetting it down. He testified that there was never an accumulation, as noted by the claimant, 2 to 3 inches thick. So the appeals officer heard this testimony. He doesn't make a finding that there was some type of exposure. The claimant said there was, but I think you need to take into account, as he did, the daily logs. The claimant put together a daily log of his activities. Nowhere in those logs did he note that he was exposed to anything. He didn't note that he was even spraying something off or chipping something off. There was nothing. And I think you need to take into account, and I hope you do, that he waited 42 days to tell a doctor. All right, counsel's up here today, as was counsel before the appeals officer, arguing that he had some type of exposure. If that exposure was so severe that he's covered in dust, he goes and changes his coveralls, right? That's his testimony. If he was exposed to something like that, and the very next day he goes in and he says, oh, I've lost some sight in my right eye, he's going to tell somebody, he's going to causally connect and tell the doctors that I was exposed to something last night. He didn't. He walked into the first doctor, and what did he tell him? I've been on high blood pressure or off my blood pressure medicine for 30 days. His blood pressure was skyrocketing. No mention of any exposure whatsoever. He goes back to a different doctor at a different hospital, and again, he notes the diabetes, the smoking, and he finally sees Dr. Jeffrey Hart, a board-certified ophthalmologist, who does the MRI and notes chronic disease in the eyes and makes no causal connection. He saw Dr. Shankar Dixit, a neurologist here in Vegas, no causal connection. He diagnoses bilateral optic neuritis. He goes back to the doctor he saw at the hospital initially, completes a C4 form, and that doctor checks the no box, no causal connection. He then sees another ophthalmologist in Vegas, Dr. Tapan Shah, 5 weeks after filing the claim, and again, there's nothing in there about him being exposed to these chemicals.
So, Mr. Benavides, how's the layperson to know that the work conditions would have caused an eye problem?
Well,
enough to even report. It's not like a slip and fall where you can think that you had a problem. By the way, we have a case where the person went 4 years later. So I don't know that 40-some days is all that bad. But you're right, it'd be better to have it reported immediately. But how is the individual to know to report that?
What I'm saying is after he did report it, after he filed the C4 form, 5 weeks later he goes to Dr. Shah and says nothing to him about being exposed.
Or maybe Dr. Shah didn't record what he said.
He's an ophthalmologist. He diagnoses.
I know I've never heard, by omission. I can't think of it. I'm not a nurse. It's something by omission. I can't think of the word. But it's like in every medical malpractice case I ever heard. You know, it's never in the record.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's not shocking that something is not in the medical record.
All right.
For a court.
Fair enough.
I mean, just out of fairness.
Fair enough. When he went, I already stated that Dr. Levine and Dr. Rogers were not presented all the medical records. And in the transcript, Attorney Armstrong, who argued this case, pointed that out to the judge. Judge, I'm not sure what records they had because I requested their records, and I'm just reading the record. And he must have held something up and said, this isn't all the records. Our records that we have are volumes. I have two boxes full of records. But he apparently held something up in his hand showing the appeals officer that these doctors were not presented all the records.
So, I mean, the problem is that's a catch-22 for you because that goes to his argument. If you're saying all the doctors here or several of them had imperfect information or may not even been told the truth, then doesn't that support his argument that maybe someone should have ordered an IME so that some doctor out there has everything before him?
Well, and that's why James Goldborough was hired. He reviewed all the records, every one of them. Every doctor, he mentions every doctor in this record.
You mean, that's the witness at the plant. You mean Dr. Hutchin?
Excuse me. Yeah. Yes, thank you. Dr. Hutchin, Dr. Kenneth Hutchin, a neuro-ophthalmologist. He had all the records. He opined to a degree of medical probability that it was due to smoking, diabetes, hypertension, and hyperlipidemia. No causal relation. So he offered his opinion to a degree of medical probability, and then the appeals officer weighed that against Dr. Levine and Dr. Rogers, who were not presented all the records. So, yes, the appeals officer could have found a medical question. He didn't. He relied on the entire record. And I do not believe that he abused his discretion.
Do you know why
his decision on substantial evidence?
Do you know why that doctor that Travelers hired was not an IME? Why not get an IME? Insurance companies do that all the time.
I have no idea quite why it wasn't done. I don't know. He just sent the records to him. He offered his opinion based on reviewing everyone's records, everyone's opinions. And he discounted the opinions of the two doctors in California. Like I said, Mr. Olson was represented for the appeals officer by Bernstein and Associates. There was no question about
Why can't this court order an independent medical? What prohibits this court from remanding it for an independent medical examination?
Well,
so that neither the plaintiffs, or sorry, now appellants and respondents, doctors, are out of the picture. And what law prevents us from remanding this down for an IME to see the cause of his blindness?
Well, I believe you'd have to find that the appeals officer abused his discretion or that his decision was not based on substantial evidence. And I would ask you not to remand back. You have eight doctors lined up on the left and two on the right.
Could this be a narrow abuse of discretion, like Judge Tao phrased it earlier, on the one issue about when you're presented with conflicting information? If you don't order an IME when it's on a serious medical question and none of the doctors did the full examination, did the full inspection of the records, so does that fit into the narrow category? Mr. Schrager is trying to say it does.
I mean, this isn't like, oh, I sprained my finger. This is somebody went blind forever.
I understand that. My heart goes out, just like Attorney Armstrong argued before the appeals officer. My heart goes out.
So what prevents this court from doing that?
I would just ask you to make a finding that there has been no abuse of discretion. You'd have to find that the appeals officer somehow abused his discretion to remand back. There's no... He considered the evidence. I mean, it was huge, and he's considered it all, and based his decision on substantial evidence.
I mean, it really comes down to the doctors is what it comes down to. I mean, let's face it. You know, the witness statements are the witness statements, but it's which doctors, and no IME was performed, and both had these. I mean, really, we're all just lay people here. We're not doctors.
That's true.
Right?
What is the situation that would cause an appeals officer to use the statute independently or sua sponte order the IME? I mean, what does it take to trigger it?
I think if there would have been a question, I think the fact that he considered the employer witness testimony, that there was no 2 to 3 inches of dust, I think he considered the fact there.
What if there's only a quarter inch of dust, but it's still blowing around? I mean, it doesn't matter if there's 2 or 3. And there's conflicting testimony, I agree, but that's not a material fact. The question is, was there a toxic substance, and did it get into the air?
I have no idea. If he would have put it on a log, if he would have told someone, they could have investigated. By the time they investigated, 42 days later, whenever it was, you know, we have a witness saying that he was working at the same time.
Well, but here's the thing. I mean, there are some cases where percipient lay testimony is important, like a classic slip and fall. You don't need a doctor to say, you know, that somebody slipped and fall. It's all going to be determined by what the witnesses, you know, saw. Was there something on the floor? Did somebody fall? And if there's no fall or if there's something on the floor, then you don't need to get to the doctor. But in this case, you have a dispute, granted there's a dispute between whether or not you saw dust or not, but it doesn't, but in a way it doesn't matter whether there was dust there or not. If a doctor comes in and says, this guy is blind because he has a toxic substance in his eye, it really doesn't matter what the witnesses saw anymore. So in a case like this, it is, as Judge Gibbons noted, it's all about the doctors and not about the lay witnesses.
If the original doctors, you'd be right. If the original doctors found something toxic in his eyes, but they didn't. There was nothing in the eyes. They looked at the eyes. They did testing on the eyes. All of them. They did. No one found anything toxic. What Dr. Levine and Dr. Rogers are saying, well, he told me that he was exposed to something toxic. He told me that.
It seems like an unfair process on somebody that's blind that a layperson, like any of us, determine, and it seems like in his review, like in his appeals officer decision, he rests solely on the fact that the retained expert by the insurance company just had some medical records. And so what, they're more believable? If you have such a close call and you're not sure who to believe, why wouldn't you get an IME in such a case? And you're just going to say, okay, well, no compensable injury, solely because one doctor had more records than another? And that's what it looks like when you read that.
When I read the transcript and looked through these records, I believe the appeals officer, after hearing the testimony of the claimant and the coworker, that he looked at the totality of evidence. He looked at the witness James Goldborough and considered his testimony that there really wasn't. There wasn't any dust or maybe some dust, but not to the extent he's talking about. And he considered his testimony, found him credible, and the daily logs. I think it was the totality of evidence that swayed him against, one, finding a medical question, and two, nobody asked for it. Alexander Boris was basing his opinion on these two doctors in California, and Attorney Armstrong was basing his opinion on the totality of evidence from these other two certified ophthalmologists and a neurologist, and the ophthalmology report of Kenneth Houchin.
You have 18 seconds. Do you have anything else? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Obviously, very briefly, within the 2 minutes I have left, I think the court has sort of narrowed the issues and the questions down to a very fine point here. I don't think I need to go back through sort of everything that I disagree with, and I don't want to, but the question of exposure is not really in question. There is testimony that the chemicals were there. There's dry puddles that are identified on top of the boiler. That all, I trust, Your Honors understand and can go back to. But the question of the medical question and the discretion of the appeals officer seems to me to be very important. And counsel says, well, look, nobody said anything. We didn't say anything. The other side didn't say anything.
Well, under abuse of discretion review, the fact that the appeals officer didn't order an IME, don't we have to read into that that he must have felt comfortable enough with what he had that he didn't need any more evidence? And why don't we defer to that decision?
That would be a leap that would be as equally plausible as he didn't know or didn't consider it. We just don't know the answer to that. And when counsel said, well, look, both sides were all in on their doctors, well, of course they were. Our doctors said toxic exposure. Their doctors said mild diabetes, whatever it was. Of course they're all in on that. No one wants to say, let's go to a tiebreaker. That may be the best reason why the discretion of the appellate or the appeals officer should be triggered here. The fact that there should be a tiebreaker is, I think, we're all sort of circling around, and this would be it. But being able to fashion a decision that, in the narrow way, as Judge Gibbons points out, that would set out circumstances in which it's appropriate, and then cases come forward where the common law on that or the interpretation gets sharpened. Right? But in this case, I think it's hard to get away from the fact that it would have lent an awful lot to the finality of this case. It also would have saved an awful lot of litigation. Because right now, as I stand here, the decision that stands, the narrative that the appeals officer stands by, is that Mr. Olson would have gone blind that day anyway had he stayed home on the couch or quit his job a month before. And that honestly beggars belief.
Thank you so much.
Other question?
Judge Gibbons has another question.
Yes.
Okay. it's not necessarily that question, though. Judge Silver alluded to this earlier. What if you have a pre-existing condition that's aggravated by the industrial situation?
Right.
I mean, there's another possible middle ground on this.
Absolutely. And I argue that in the brief, we didn't get to it here, is that the logic of Dr. Houchin's opinion is that there are these pre-existing conditions that were potentially aggravated by the exposure at work. And in that case, the entire standard is different. Right? All of a sudden, it becomes the burden of respondent to come forward with a preponderance of the evidence to say, no, it didn't. Right? Right. We never even got
right. But is there any evidence of that? Maybe there was no need to go there.
Well, I mean, the evidence brought forward is respondent's evidence, frankly. Mm-hmm. Right? That here are the reasons why you're going blind. Right, because you have mild diabetes, because of your tobacco use, because of hypertension, things that thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of Nevadans have every day but aren't blind. Right, but if those are the, but if that's what they're going to stand on, it does open up that question, Judge Gibbons.
Okay.
Thank you both for your arguments. We really appreciate both sides' very thorough briefing of this case, and we appreciate your being here and your arguments. This case will stand submitted, and.